There are 23 species in Wisconsin that are considered endangered or threatened. They include the gray wolf, the rusty-patched bumblebee, and the prairie bush clover. A new book examines what endangered species can tell us about our part of the world and what they say about us. Adam Rain Arvidson is a science reporter and landscape architect in Minneapolis. He's the author of the new book, Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. It comes out next month. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, why are you fascinated by endangered and threatened species kind of in our own backyards here?
My fascination for the wild and rare really starts with the landscape itself. I grew up in the Midwest, but not in the upper Midwest, not in Minnesota, though I've traveled kind of throughout there and across Wisconsin numerous times. And for me, the landscape of the upper Midwest is this really fascinating place that is much more varied than people give it credit for. You know, when you think about the difference between the driftless area to the shores of Lake Michigan, there's a huge variety there. And there are endangered and threatened species in every one of these types of landscapes. And, you know, I think that they're a really important part of those landscapes and that there might be something that we'd miss without having them there. So I come at it from a landscape perspective, but in researching this, I've learned a lot of interesting stories about these species themselves.
Yeah, you were, you know, not just kind of sitting at home writing about this. You went out with people, you know, collecting mussels from waterways and looking for these hard-to-find plants, elusive mammals, too, for that matter. What does it look like when you're out in the field seeing these endangered and threatened species in their own homes?
Well, for each one of these species, there is a dedicated scientist or group of scientists that spends sometimes an entire career studying them, learning how they make their living, learning what they're contributing to the landscape, how they're living in that landscape. And they are out in the field. They have to go out in the field and do this. And many of them were very generous with their time with me to let me tag along and sometimes help out with the surveys. I in the driftless area of Minnesota, I got to climb to the top of a 30-foot aluminum stepladder propped up against a cliff so that we could look at this rare plant that literally grows out of the cliff. I've been hip deep in the snows of the Northwoods, looking for lynx, following their tracks. I even kind of went out on my own and kayaked the shores of Wisconsin Point near Superior to look for areas that have been restored for piping plover habitat. So it's been fun to get out there and get up close and personal with this landscape, and many of those stories are related in the book.
Now you profile a bunch of different species of a bunch of different types. Before we get into maybe a couple specifics, you wrap up with some concern about our commitment to protect endangered species. What has you worried?
What has me worried is that, you know, we are 50 years removed from a real outpouring of environmental legislation that took place in the 60s and 70s. We had the Endangered Species Act in 1973, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. All these were passed right around that time. And incidentally, there was a whole lot of environmental literature that was going on at that same time, starting with the famous Wisconsin ecologist Aldo Leopold, who actually said that the first rule of responsible tinkering is to keep every part. And I really feel like we're losing some of those parts. And that 50 years later, we've sort of entered a situation where instead of the old sort of bipartisan way of looking at environmental legislation, keep in mind most of that landmark environmental legislation was signed by President Nixon after bipartisan efforts in Congress. Here we have really a battle between ideologies, and it's causing the Endangered Species Act itself to suffer. I think there's a lack of funding kind of going along with that right now. And we may really see some of these things wink out. And people hear a lot about the wolf, for instance, maybe the lynx. But there's a lot of other plants and animals that are smaller, they're less flashy, but they may play a critical part in our landscapes. And I think right now it's difficult to think that at a moment when we need to sort of reboot after 50 years, we're actually maybe taking a step backwards.
We're talking to Adam Rain Arvidson, author of the new book Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. Well, let's turn to something a little less flashy, as you're just mentioning, mussels. And when we hear mussels in the news, we hear about kind of the bad guy of the region, the zebra mussels, the invasive species. There's a lot of mussels native to this part of the world that face threats. Talk about some of those characters.
So these are characters indeed, and freshwater mussels are actually one of the hardest hit types of animals that we have across the Midwest, and they have such spectacular names. Like, one thing I love about them is what they're called. There are five endangered mussels in Minnesota and Wisconsin because we share many of the same rivers. You know, names like the winged maple leaf, the sheep nose, the snuff box, the Higgins eye pearly mussel. You know, these animals can live to be almost 100 years old. And they're in a lot of the big rivers, the St. Croix, the Mississippi. And they've really been impacted over the past 50 years, really, by water quality. And we're not that long removed from a time when sort of raw sewage could be dumped into the rivers. And things have cleaned up considerably. And there's actually significant efforts to be reintroducing mussels to the big rivers of the Midwest. And there's been some huge success funded in part by money that comes with endangered species listing. So there are scientists out there literally scuba diving in the Minnesota, the Mississippi, the St. Croix, finding these mussel beds, and in some cases cultivating mussels in labs and reimplanting them back into the river now that the waters are cleaner.
And they play a role in water quality, the food chain themselves, right, these freshwater mussels?
They do. The mussels are filter feeders, and so they are essentially opening up their shells and taking river water into their shells and eating the junk that flows down the river. So they do. There is a link to water clarity and water quality. The thing that's pretty fascinating about mussels is that in order to reproduce, they actually need a fish host. They're semi-parasitic, and mussels will actually catch a fish in their shell and flush their larvae over the fish's gills. And the tiny little mussels, called glochidia, ride on those gills for a time, and then they drop off when they're mature enough to live on their own. And the mussels have devised some pretty ingenious ways of doing this. Some of them almost put out a lure that looks like a worm that the fish will bite on. There's one mussel, the snuffbox, which simply pretends to be a rock. And when fish start turning it over looking for food, it snaps shut on that mussel's face and won't let it go until it's got some glochidia attached to its gills.
I want to take a look at one of the plant species that you feature, the prairie bush clover. It's listed as threatened here in Wisconsin, I think. And you call it a kind of a minor player in the book, and you ask, you know, why does it matter? And what did you find out about why the prairie bush clover matters?
The prairie bush clover matters, in my view, in a somewhat philosophical way. So the story of the prairie bush clover is the story of the rather rapid conversion of an entire ecosystem, the prairie, to cropland over a very short period of time. So around the turn of the 1800s, 1900s, over the course of about 40 years, the United States lost 99% of its prairie. And that's a total acreage that's about half of what the Amazon rainforest constitutes today. And nobody much said anything about it. And the prairie bush clover is endangered. The prairie itself is really endangered. And so the question that I ask in the book is, you know, we don't know what specific component the prairie bush clover plays in the prairie, but we also don't know what other species we may have already lost by essentially changing this ecosystem so extraordinarily. It also illustrates a point of the power of the Endangered Species Act. This is a legislation that works. And because the prairie bush clover is listed, its habitat has to be protected. And there's been a lot of effort across the Midwest, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and elsewhere, to make sure that there is prairie set aside and preserved legally so that the prairie bush clover can survive, but there's a whole lot of other friends that it has in that landscape that now get a place to live because it was protected by legislation.
Adam, as you mentioned, you did a lot of hands-on work with scientists, meeting these species in person when possible, and in some cases you were out there with your kids looking at these species and being out there with the next generation. Does that kind of shape your thinking about wanting to keep these things around for them to see and maybe their kids to see and so on down the road?
Oh, I think it's absolutely critical. You know, I've been working on this book for about 9 years, and my oldest son is 9 years old. So he has traveled with me throughout the Midwest at various stages of his development. And it really hits home for me with the butterflies. We've seen a huge crash in butterfly populations, especially prairie butterflies. They're virtually gone from the Midwest. And the butterfly is an absolutely amazing creature that sort of every kid can recite the Hungry Caterpillar book. And they have an affinity for butterflies. And it's a little scary to imagine a time when they won't go out into the field and see butterflies. And so I think there's an importance on preserving that, too, even if just to make sure that the kids understand the richness that we have of life here on Earth.
And briefly, as a wrap-up, I mean, there's a lot of sad stories or worrisome stories, but there are success stories. When we do things, it often works.
That's true. We've seen some real rebounds in places. I just mentioned butterflies. The Minnesota Zoo has raised captive prairie butterflies and successfully released them into the wild last summer. So that's a huge, huge bright spot. The piping plover, apparently there was a nesting pair in northern Minnesota this year for the first time in nine years, a pair nested on the shores of Lake of the Woods in Minnesota. And then, you know, I think the lynx has been proposed for delisting, in part because the science has shown that it's actually has a fairly robust population in northern Minnesota. I think there's always cause for hope. But the Endangered Species Act really works, and it's important to keep that in place, both for the purposes of research and to make sure that there's funding coming to that research for these animals and plants.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Adam Rain Arvidson. His new book is Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest.